Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Turfgrass Epistemology. My name is Travis Shaddix. Thank you for joining me. It's going to be a fun afternoon. I had many requests, and I was able to, and he was able to find time in his busy schedule to come join me today. We've been going over biostimulants, and that's an area, as you all know, I've mentioned in the channel, I am not an expert in biostimulants at all. I can read the literature, but I know just enough to be in trouble and get myself in trouble. And so I've asked today one of my topics is, like I said, is biostimulants. One guest I've always wanted to have on here is Dr. Urban, who has written one of the more compelling papers in biostimulant science on turfgrass. Dr. Urban, thank you for being here today.
Hey, thanks, Travis. Glad to be here and looking forward to talking this hour.
Yeah. Like I said, I've had several requests, and there's already some people in the chat today already talking about thanking you for being here. You know, we have OSU Turf Man from Ohio saying thank you to Dr. Urban for all your research. He tells you it's been incredibly helpful throughout his career that what you've done in terms of publishing your work, Dr. Urban. So it
wonderful. It's great to hear people are paying attention.
Well, that's one thing I've felt too in the channel. It's like you get busy and your head's down. And you're doing work and you're working with students. You're working with committees and you're doing this and you know. And you do your talks and you do everything you can. But I don't really, in my academic career, I didn't get a whole lot of feedback like, man, this is really helpful to me occasionally. But people on this channel are so friendly and they really make a point of saying, thanks so much for taking the time to, you know, educate us and say it in a way that we can use it. And you've already gotten many compliments and we've only been on for 30 seconds. So it speaks to your professional expertise in this area.
Well, all right. Like it.
Eric, I am familiar with your academic history, but I'm not really that familiar at all with how you even got into the turf grass science industry at all. Do you mind kind of giving us an elevator speech on how you got to where you're at?
Sure. It started growing up two blocks from my local nine-hole country club in Iowa. Started playing golf because my dad was a golfer, and at the age of six, Indian Creek Country Club was my babysitter. I'd go play some golf. I could stop and jump in the pool and get back on the golf course, and really loved it. By the time I was 12, I was the cart boy, the bag boy, washing the clubs for the members, and actually, you know, running the pro shop when the pro was out for a little bit. And then when I was 14, I graduated to working on the grounds crew with Dave Peterson, my first superintendent. He was just out of a two-year turf degree, making $12,000 back then. So I loved working for Dave. It was a three-person crew on this little nine-hole course, and I always thought I was going to become a golf course superintendent. So before I graduated high school, he had moved on to go down to Orlando and build Grand Cypress, Jack Nicklaus set of golf courses. And he didn't want to directly hire me, not because he didn't like me, but because he wanted me to get some more experience under different superintendents. So he hooked me up with a job at Bay Hill, working at Arn Palmer's place. Moved down there when I was 18 before I went to college. And learned how to make a good wage. But, you know, I was low person on the totem pole, edging bunkers and fighting fire ants down there, and decided, hey, I need to go to college so I can become the superintendent. I always intended to go to college. So I moved back home and went to Iowa State and got my horticulture degree, focused on turf science under Dr. Nick Christians. Great mentor. And the whole time there, every summer I worked at another one of my home courses, which is Cedar Rapids Country Club. It's the premier course in the area. It's the only Donald Ross designed course in Iowa. And had a great time under Superintendent Jack Rhodes there. And my last summer, the assistant superintendent had moved on to a head superintendent job. So I got to step in as the assistant superintendent for the summer, the last summer before I graduated. And got a real sense of what my career was going to be like. We had a drought that year, and we ran out of water. Our well ran out of water. We had to go deeper. We hit some more water, but I got to sleep at the pump house and turn it on and off, and started thinking about my life. I know I'm telling you a lot here, but I really enjoyed being at the university, and so I decided I wanted to go on for a graduate degree, and ended up at the University of Colorado first, and then eventually at Colorado State University under Dr. Tony Koski for my master's and my PhD. Funnily, working on my the first project for my master's was on drought tolerance and irrigation requirements of Kentucky bluegrass, tall fescue, and buffalo grass. And then my PhD was all about Primo and its effects on traffic tolerance, nitrogen needs, and water use, as Primo was just coming out on the market in the early 90s and starting to be used heavily. So that was my career.
So I have a quick question. How did you end up with your master's at Boulder? You got a master's at Boulder, right? Colorado.
Yep. University of Colorado, Boulder.
But that has nothing to do with science at turf at all, or agriculture.
No, nope, doesn't have anything to do about it. So you can tell maybe when I was sleeping at the pump house, I was having a career crisis. And at the time I was in a serious relationship, and I was always interested in philosophy. Actually, I got my horticulture BS with a philosophy minor. And so my girlfriend at the time, we were living together, and she was political science and philosophy. And we said, okay, we're going to go get a master's in philosophy. And we applied a few places together. We thought we were going to become teachers. I did become a teacher. And we both got in at University of Colorado Boulder. So we ended up there, took out some loans, worked hard, worked at Boulder Country Club actually there. And found out that that wasn't for me. But I became a much better critical thinker and writer because of that. And so when that ended, and I wasn't going to become a high school teacher or community college teacher, I found this opportunity with Dr. Koski for my master's, my second master's at Colorado State, and no regrets. That was lucky coincidence.
I didn't set you up on purpose for that, but that's where I was going with your first master's degree, is that it seems to me that a degree such as that, philosophy, or even a Juris Doctorate or some sort of degree in law, where you're required to think critically and think about, you know, flaws in reasoning and develop arguments properly. It's in the latter part of my career now, it's helped me write better and present better and to engage in conversations better it has nothing to do with turf at all. So your first master's really intrigued me, because I thought that would be an interesting.
We're on the turf grass epistemology show, it's the philosophy of how we know things. So
that's right.
How do we know things about turf grass science?
That's exactly what it is.
Why we're here today.
How do we know what we know? And
good stuff.
and it's always interesting to me, like, you know, knowing what I know now, thinking back, it's like, oh, I used to do this, I used to do that, I used to think this, and now it's like, wait a second, I'm doing something different. So it wasn't. It was that I was wrong, but I didn't think I was wrong. I thought I was doing the right thing. And looking back on it, it's like, if I ask myself now, how did I know what I was doing was correct back then? How did I know that? Well, I didn't think critically back then. I was just doing whatever everybody else was doing and following the leader. And I didn't stop and think, wait a second, is there a better way to build this mousetrap? You know, and why are we doing this and so forth? So that's what the channel is all about, trying to think critically as my
good
audience
stuff.
Will fill you on. Well, on the preamble, we're doing biostimulants, and I think my 12-year-old son knows more about biostimulants than I do. And I'm telling you, I get in trouble every time I move outside my lane. And so one of my initial positions, whether it's right or wrong, I'm learning, is that it seems like there is some value to some biostimulants, but it tends to be sort of specific to certain types of stresses, i.e. salt, which was actually some work done in Colorado on that on some fairways. On drought, there may be some heat-related stresses that these biostimulants can assist with. But in general, without those stresses, it's the effect is less pronounced. And the papers that I've read up to this point, as I was talking to you before we even came on the show, they don't do as good a job as this paper does on diagnosing or determining what is actually in the products and more accurately separating out the effect of the biostimulant in the product relative to the element in the product. And this paper does a good job at that. So I really want to get into it and just have hopefully help guide me through it so I don't make any mistakes.
Sure.
So let's get into it. So this paper, for those listening, is entitled Cytokinin Containing Seaweed and Humic Acid Extract Associated with Creeping Bentgrass Leaf Cytokinins and Drought Resistance. Now, you all published this in Crop Science, which for those people who are just joining the channel who might be new, Crop Science is our top-tier journal outside of Science and Nature, but our turf grass-related journals, it's at the top of the list, and it was published in 2004. Do you want to kind of give our audience, Dr. Irvin, a brief introduction as to how this project came about and how you began, you know, working with these biostimulants?
Sure thing. So it really goes back to getting prepared whenever you're going to interview for a new job. So I came out of Colorado State in 1998. I was fortunate enough to become assistant professor and state turf grass extension specialist at University of Missouri. And as you heard, I worked on drought and traffic and nitrogen and plant growth regulators and how to use all those things properly. So I hadn't worked with biostimulants. But one thing that I was interested in with Primo is plant hormones. So Primo cuts the ability of the plant to produce the leaf elongation hormone gibberellic acid in half, and therefore with repeated applications, keeping that suppression of the grass plant in check, you save on mowing and so on. But there are other secondary effects that we started to see there. So I was interested in hormones from that work. When I was asked to apply two and a half years in at Missouri to the job at Virginia Tech, it was to replace Dr. Dick Schmidt, who had an amazing 40-year career as the turf grass professor and expert in Virginia Tech. So in the last decade of his career, he was really the pioneer into the first studies of seaweed extracts and humic acids and what beneficial effects they may or may not have in terms of cool season grasses in particular when they encounter stress or just normal summer conditions. So he was working with a postdoc at the time that you see on all of our papers, Dr. Xinjiang Zhang. And I got the job, and as part of researching the job, it's like, okay, he's started to build this early literature on these new biostimulant products, but he's only kind of pointing to what may be in them and what they may be doing physiologically in the plant. And as someone who hadn't worked with any of these products yet, I got there and I said, okay, here are my questions. Can I first, good science is, can I repeat some of the results they've published already? And second, if I can do that, can I answer some deeper questions in terms of why might these products be changing the physiological function of the plant in response to these stresses? And so this was my first study that I designed with Dr. Zhang and some input from Dr. Schmidt. He would still come in, you know, we talk over coffee in his retirement, and here's what I'm thinking. And he was thinking, yes, there must be something hormonal happening to upregulate the plant's ability to keep photosynthesizing a little bit longer. That means it's keeping its chlorophyll around and active longer. And, during these stresses, and if you can keep photosynthesizing, stay greener longer during these stresses, one of the hormones that's involved in a stay green effect during stress is cytokinin. And so those were some of his hypotheses, and I designed this experiment to try to address those hypotheses.
Perfect. Yeah. So thank you for the introduction. That clarifies some questions I had on my end, exactly how you got to there. So you came in as a new professor. There was already a little bit of work being done there. There was a postdoc there, Dr. Zhang, who's on how many papers with you? Four,
many,
five,
many
six.
Papers.
I don't even know how many papers. Yeah.
He's a very good scientist. Yep.
They all came out in like 4 or 5 years, just boom, 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 boom. And I was like, man, that's got to be a postdoc, because there was some of the best money spent as an assistant or any professor is spent on postdocs who know how to write.
Because they know how to write and know how to, they don't have any responsibilities for teaching. So mm-hmm. they're just in the lab helping you conduct all this research and collect the data. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fantastic. They're really worth their weight in gold. You can get ones that have a vision and a direction. They're motivated. Yeah. So, you know, just real briefly, just so what you said, you're dealing with creeping bentgrass. You talk about how it's a cool season turf. It has poor drought avoidance. And then you just like you mentioned in the introduction, you talk about cytokinins in the introduction of the paper and how it has anti-senescent properties. And you have some citations for that. And you do a little bit, two or three sentences on the speciation of certain cytokinins being the zeaxanthin, I suppose, and the isopentyl adenine. The only reason I mention that is because he's actually going to measure that in this paper to the audience. Mm-hmm. They're going to measure that. So they talk about it briefly in their introduction. And natural products. I just want to read this one paragraph so I don't get too out of whack. Natural products which contain phytohormones or exhibit hormone-like activity have received increasing attention for the use of for use as a nutrient supplement in agriculture and horticulture. Seaweed extracts and humic acids are in common use as major components in turf grass and ornamental biostimulant formulations. So I guess the classic definition of a biostimulant is any compound that can impart a beneficial response in the turf, or in our world, turf grass, that is not attributed to the nutritional component of the actual product. Is that fair enough?
Yep, that's okay. Fair enough. Yep.
And so I guess that's one reason why over coffee, which I think there's been more great studies designed over coffee and donuts in the morning in some of these places than we do at some meetings. But you and your predecessor were talking about it has to be a hormonal sort of influence. And that's the direction you all went based upon some little bit of knowledge from the literature that you pulled out. So let me read the, where is it at? Oh, there's something I'll just read the objective. So of the audience listening, because there's going to be some people listening who aren't watching. The objectives of the study were several. There's four objectives that they used. Unless you want to go over it, doctor, you want me to just read it? Does it matter?
Sure. No, I'll read through it and
okay.
give you a little background. So determine if cultivar variation exists in response to drought and natural product foliar applications. So, you know, in the late 90s, we saw the commercial release of Penn A4 and Penn G2 and those series selected by the Penn State folks from naturally adapted Penn cross varieties that have been maintained at Augusta National for years and years. And this certain phenotype, they kept noticing was twice as dense as the old Penn cross that was on the greens. And, okay. You know, anything denser, that can handle the heat and probably drought stress of Augusta National, can also handle the lower mowing heights, became very popular. So, we wanted to test Penn cross, the old standard here that a lot of people were still managing on, greens and fairways. L93, which had become really the standard on greens and fairways, and then the newest types that we hypothesized and were selected for their low mowing tolerance and their drought and heat tolerance to see if we'd see any genetic differences, even though, you know, there are a lot of probably parents in common across these three cultivars.
Okay.
Okay. Then test previous reports of improvement of bentgrass drought resistance due to foliar application of these materials. That was all the previous Schmidt and Zhang work that was published in the late 90s. Examine if these natural products affect creeping bentgrass leaf tissue levels of alpha tocopherol. That's vitamin E. That's an important plant produced vitamin to stabilize cellular membranes during stress. A lot of us will apply vitamin E when we use hand lotion or face lotion, because it's an important compound to help keep our skin cells healthy. And leaf tissue levels of cytokinin. So this is the new part. No one had measured in response to application of seaweed extracts and humic acids alone or in combination, whether or not we can measure increased level of this important anti-senescence hormone in the leaf tissues where the product was applied. And then determine if changes in alpha tocopherol, vitamin E, and cytokinins are associated with improved drought resistance. So not a direct cause and effect, but if we can show that, one, there are actual cytokinins in the products themselves before we apply them, and we are able to show that as a first report of that, do they then boost these cytokinin levels during stress or even without stress, drought or well water conditions in the leaf tissue? The important part about cytokinins is they're naturally produced in healthy root tips. And then they move up in the transpiration stream to the leaves to have these anti-senescence and other type of effects. As we all know, as summer stress is occurring, we're just hoping we can keep around as many roots that developed in the spring so that there's some kind of roots still there by the end of the summer to support the health of the plant. And so there's not going to be a lot of new root tips being developed in under summer stress. So, okay, can we then just supply with the seaweed extract or the humic acid that cytokinin directly to the leaf tissue? So when it's not being produced naturally because not much root activity in the summer, we boost it with these products. Okay. So those are the hypotheses. So
that clarifies some things in my mind a little bit about the rationale behind how this particular product might be useful in summer heat. If we're going to assume that there is a reduction in root growth and new root tips in the summer on these cool season grasses, which is probably a good assumption, then in turn, there may be a reduction in cytokinin production and so forth. And supplying it at that time might result in a beneficial response in turn. Okay. That was the connection in y'all's mind. Okay.
Right. And we need to, plant is respiring, metabolizing, turning over its carbon compounds, its energy reserves every day, right? And that metabolism just shoots up in the summer. So you can't think that you can apply this product and to the leaf tissue and think that it's, and then you're mowing, right? And think that it's just going to be there for the next 3 months, right?
Yeah.
So then it's what we did in this study and many others is every 30-day application or every 2-week application to keep supplementing these during compounds.
So can we speculate? Yeah. I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit here, just basically in a means to help me understand this. So if that's the case where the application of cytokinin-containing biostimulants results in a beneficial response, which is what we're going to find in this paper, because the root production has been reduced, we also see some papers that show benefit when under salt stress, and we see some benefit under some, not just drought stress, but heat stress. So is all that a root-related phenomenon that's occurring, a stress on the plant, and then that's why we're seeing responses in those, under those stresses to cytokinins? Is it? You think it's a reduction in root growth?
It's really a reduction in photosynthesis and carbon production.
Okay.
And so if our carbon production factory, our leaf tissue, is stressed by heat, drought, salt, an herbicide application, anything that causes oxidative stress or free radical production. So as light's hitting the leaf tissue, and it's being absorbed by chlorophyll, it excites that electron that then moves through the photosystem to produce ATP and NADPH, when then the plant can turn that into carbohydrates or proteins, right? But the less and less efficiently that occurs because of heat stress or drought stress or salt stress, the more of, and but the same amount of light still hitting that leaf tissue, right? So sometimes it's not going to excite that chlorophyll to make that energy. It's just going to be fluoresced off as heat, or it's going to combine with oxygen and not get quenched by water, and it turns into what's called a free radical, which then is like a bullet bouncing around in the cell and breaking down the cells or breaking down the chlorophyll pigment. And then there's less energy made, but there's all this stress. It's just exactly how we get a sunburn.
Okay. Kind of thinking the same thing.
So, and you know, so we could try to, you know, plants over time, certain cultivars are darker green. And so have more pigments to quench this high light when things aren't moving through the photosystem efficiently. And we actually have published a couple of papers on this. Darker green Kentucky bluegrass cultivars are a little bit more tolerant to high light and heat. We can try to put a, you know, a sunscreen on the plants. People, you know, that's part of probably what's going on with, you know, the signature products or any of these products that have a blue green pigment that you're artificially coating the leaf. It's kind of a UV protection. So I know I'm getting off subject.
No,
but,
it's fine. I'm learning.
But that's
learning.
that's really what we think is going on here is we're just naturally cytokines are known to reduce the activity of enzymes that cause the slow breakdown of chlorophyll. That's how it's a stay green type of product. And but it's got to be in the leaf tissue. If it's not coming up from healthy root tips, we're going to apply it with the seaweed extract and hopefully keep that those levels boosted so we can slow the degradation of chlorophyll under these stresses.
Okay, that's a great example. At least, I mean, again, I'm ignorant when it comes to this topic, but if I think I'm understanding what you're saying. So I guess to wrap up that explanation, I guess what in my mind, what I'm wondering is, because we generally in literature see a more pronounced benefit under stress than we do when it's not stressed, which is generally what we're going to find in this paper, it sounds to me like it's primarily a result of reduced roots and therefore the reduced production of cytokines, but it sounds to me like there may be some other things going on. But certainly like, let's say, for example, I we're talking about drought in this study, and someone goes, well, what about this stress? I'm wondering, can I say, well, does that stress result in a reduction in cytokines or a reduction in new root growth? Then am I fair to say that it's likely that if that stress does result in reduced root growth, that the application of a cytokining could help during that stressful period, or am I stretching on that?
No, I don't think you're stretching. I think the main thing to keep in mind is that the plant, when it's under stress, is going to change how it allocates energy to favor the shoots, the photosynthetic factories. So when there's stress occurring, it's going to not send as much energy down into the roots. And therefore, as the stress continues day after day, the roots get fed less and less, and so they start to decline in favor of energy staying up there for the leaf tissue to keep photosynthesizing, to try to, you know, eventually everything's gonna die, but the roots die first, and then secondarily the shoots go.
I could be here for 5 hours asking questions. I gotta get going, or we'll be here for, so let's get into materials and methods. Do you want to go through that real briefly? I've just highlighted a few things, but you're welcome to explain it however you like.
Oh boy. So we took these plugs from 2-year-old mature stands of these three varieties. We took them in the greenhouse. We grew them. This was a silt clay loam native soil off of a fairway area where these cultivars were. And then we put them in fairly big 4-liter metal containers. Think of big Folgers coffee cup, big coffee containers. Of course, there's drainage holes. And then we mix that silt loam topsoil with a USGA sand to really have kind of a sandy loam that you would find maybe on a push-up putting green that's been top-dressed with pure sand over and over again.
Okay.
So standard light and, 24 degrees Celsius, 20 degrees day, night, greenhouse is, 68 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit. We allowed them to re-root for a month, before we started, and they were well watered, no stress before we started applying the products. So our treatments were a seaweed extract from Ascophyllum notosum. That's the standard brown kelp or North Atlantic seaweed that's used in most products that are commercially available. Mm-hmm. The one we used was from Acadian Sea Plants in Nova Scotia that really a number of branded products. They're the wholesaler.
Okay.
That would go into a number of turf products.
Mm-hmm.
The rates, half a kilogram per hectare of the seaweed extract were based on the previous Schmidt research, as was the Leonardite humic acid. Leonardite humic acid is, 80% of it is this humic acid. It's it's highly decomposed, soft brown coal, really. It's not high enough quality coal to burn for energy, but it's used for other things, mined in South Dakota, places like that. You can see 1.5 kilograms. These are basically rates if we translate them to a turf label of something like 1.5 to 3 ounces per 1,000 square feet.
Okay.
And that's, we've stayed with these same rates throughout many of our papers, sprayed them out just like you would, through your sprayers and, and they were sprayed either alone or, in combination. And then there was an untreated control. We also, did a trial where we, burned up these products. These are organic materials, meaning they contain lots of carbon, naturally produced, but they also are going to have mineral elements, NPK, micronutrients in them. Mm-hmm. So as a check on the mode of action, we wanted to burn away all the carbon compounds, anything that could be carbohydrates or sugars or these hormones, and leave the mineral fraction, NPK micronutrients, and apply that just to check and see, are the tiny amounts of mineral nutrients in these products at these very low rates going to have a nutritional effect to that would be separate from this biostimulant hormonal effect.
Brilliant. Who came up with that idea? That's brilliant.
I guess I did. I mean, it's kind of a standard thing to do to have these kind of positive controls, they're called in a lot of different scientific work.
Well,
we want to report the data and not have them saying, well, did you think of this?
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
No, we didn't.
People are going to shoot holes in it. That's fine. But a different type of approach would probably be to like just measure the phosphorus and then apply that type of that phosphorus in some, whatever, but just simply to burn it off and whatever, phosphorus isn't going anywhere, the potassium isn't going anywhere, and then just apply that. That's brilliant. I think it's a more simple way to do it.
Yeah, and just to let the listeners know, I mean, the standard analyses of these products that you would be able to purchase, and these would be like a 0.001.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if you do the math on what 1% potassium is, the rate we applied at 3 ounces per thousand, you know, it's minuscule in terms of changing how much potassium would be available to go into leaf tissues.
So you imparted some stress on the plants. You basically split them in half on one of the trials. And you want to just, I mean, briefly explain that? I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, so half we kept well watered or maintained at field capacity. That's basically, okay, we've got a 1-inch rainfall. We let it drain for 24 hours. And what's left is field capacity. The all the micro pores, the small pores remain filled with water, and all the macro pores are full of air. And that's where we want to start. A lot of our sandy soils that we work with, field capacity soil moisture, if you used a TDR, would be, you know, 15 to 25% volumetric soil moisture. So we were probably with this sandy loam keeping them around 25% soil moisture all the time. And then we just went a whole month without, for the drought pots, they just didn't get watered for the month. And we just monitored how long it took them to get to the wilting point, which is right around this negative 1.5 megapascals, or if we use, again, the volumetric soil moisture, around 5% when you start having so water held so tightly that the plant roots can't get it at it, at it anymore.
Okay. Yeah. So you kind of just let some of them go all the way down to wilting, and other ones you kept well water. We're going to see the effect of that. And you, during that time, or actually some of these after that drought period occurred, depending on which variable you're measuring, you measured photochemical efficiency, quality, and growth measurement. Is there anything you want to discuss there?
Yeah, well, just I'll just say quickly, photochemical efficiency is a measure we can take to see how efficiently light is being captured to produce ATP and carbohydrates through the photosystems, as I talked through before. And basically, it's we dark adapt the plants so that all light energy transfer stops in the dark, and then we'll pulse them with a certain wavelength of light that's photosynthetically active. And what bounces back, or what's called fluoresces, is how much did not move through the photosystem and be captured, but is reflected back out and not used for energy production. The higher that efficiency, the higher, you know, photosynthetic rates are going to be happening. And so really healthy leaf tissue, they're right around 0.65, 0.7 on this scale, 0.75. And then as we get more and more stress and less efficiency of light capture to produce energy, it goes down to 0.5, 0.4, so on.
Okay.
So we're able to measure that as the experiment goes on.
Okay.
And, you know, we took, we didn't mow these at putting green height or even fairway height. What did we keep them at?
I'll have to look through.
Anyway, it's okay. But we had to stop mowing, to be able to harvest enough leaf tissue to do our analysis of how much cytokinin's in the leaf tissue, how much alpha tocopherol is in the leaf tissue.
Okay.
As the experiments went on, so we could get like an every 2 week time course of these responses.
Okay. Yeah. You couldn't get enough tissue if you cut it up, putting green height. It makes sense.
Right.
Okay. So you measured quality on 1 to 9 with 6 minimal. You also, so the alpha tocopherol, I can't even say
that. Well, let's say vitamin E. That's easy.
Vitamin E, you measured that, and you had the explanation of how you did that, the cytokinin extract and assay. You know, it's pretty straightforward. You know, I don't know if there's any.
Yeah. Just what I wanted to report to everybody is you know, we measured that there are biologically significant amounts of cytokinins in the products themselves before we applied them.
Okay.
And that's at a microgram level. So 10 to the -3.
You want to just, I can come down to that right now.
Yeah.
I think it's here in table 1, right?
Table 1. Okay. Yeah, in the product. So
right here,
basically 57 to 60, micrograms, in the products themselves. Zeatin ribozide is the sugar form that is in the leaf tissues, that is the storage form. So the plant can then, when it wants to use the cytokinin, it'll cleave off the ribozide, the sugar portion of it, and you have pure zeatin that then does the activity in the plant.
Okay.
So if we were trying to measure just pure zeatin, it would be changing second by second, right? Mm. And so it's easier to measure this storage form and get a sense of how that changes every 2 weeks. So we're able to show that there's significant amounts. And then once the in table one here, when the experiment was going on, I believe this was at the end of the trial. So either 28 days of drought we were at 35%. Volumetric soil moisture, not 25%, sorry. But you can see that we go from about 11 or 12 in the well-watered, no stress condition, to about 15 to 19 in the drought stressed. And this is in nanograms, so that's 10 to the negative ninth. So we go from a product that's applied in water to the leaf tissue at 10 to the negative third concentration. Remember, a hormone, definition of a hormone is something in minute quantities that has a big physiological effect on the plant.
Okay.
And so we're going from something that's 10 to the negative third concentration and then seeing what it does in the plant. It's in the plant, it's functioning at a 10 to the negative ninth concentration, which is in line with other studies and other plant species and the levels that have been found in their leaf tissues.
Okay.
And you can see a small but statistically significant increase between no stress conditions and stress conditions from, you know, 12 to 19 or something.
You're talking about the difference between these two columns?
Yeah, I am.
And then for those reading, if you choose to read this in the future, that what we should be looking at, and you correct me where I'm wrong, doctor, is that the control is here, down here at the bottom. Let's say when it's under stress, it's 15.9 nanograms.
Right.
And when we're not, the all these here are just further positive, further controls. In other words, these are the ash samples, meaning you shouldn't see much at all. If you did see any difference here, it'd be a result of the elemental components of the biostimulant, not the hormone. I guess you want to call it hormonal components of the biostimulant.
Right.
And so what we do is we would compare this one down here, the control, to this group up here. And that's where we would determine, in fact, the application of these biostimulants resulted in an increase, decrease, or did not result in anything at all compared to applying them or not applying them. So, and we see that, in fact, all of these, the humic acid, the seaweed extract, and both of them combined, resulted in greater quantities of this ZR, this zeatin, than the control.
Exactly.
When it was under stress. When it was not under water stress, these two up here, just the straight humic acid and seaweed extract, didn't separate out. It took the combination of the two to pull out from the control. And I'm looking at that. Am I reading that correctly?
Yep. You've got it right.
Okay.
Yep.
So if there is, you know, this is, we're talking about leaf cytokinins. And what I've talked about before in the audience was, the people who are familiar with the channel will be very familiar with this statement. And that is, I'm not overly concerned about the means to an end as I am about the end, and then using the means to explain the end. And so this to me is a means to an end. The end being turf quality or turf color or some characteristic that we care about. But to me, if we see, which we will, if we see a positive influence in terms of turf quality, correct me where I'm wrong, doctor, these sorts of results would help explain why we're seeing the turf quality change. Is that fair?
Right. It's how strong is the correlation, or as the paper says, the association. If we see an increase in leaf cytokinins, do we see a corresponding increase in quality? And we did.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. So for, unless you have something you want to discuss, I'm gonna let the audience know that I'm probably gonna skip through a lot of the differences among the different cultivars of bentgrass, unless Doctor, you feel inclined.
They were very small.
Okay, and that's what this is here. This is the terp quality, but this is comparing bentgrass cultivars, which there's people who are interested in that. But I'm interested in this, for example, this, and I know Doctor, some people. Turf quality subjective and this and that. But to me, I just want some metric that the end user or my clients or the sod producer or somebody cares about, green and no weeds or increased growth or in something. And that's what this says. So on the x-axis, for those listening, we'll have days after initiation of dry down from 0 to 30, or really from 0 to probably 28 days, something like that.
Yep.
And then we have turf quality on the y-axis, and we have the turf grass quality resulting from the various treatments, humic acid, seaweed extract, both of them combined, or the control. So you want to walk us through this graph, the turf quality, as we see it change as we dry down?
Yeah. So really, as it dry downs, we don't see any difference in loss in quality at week 7, but at day 14, we start seeing a separation, and we can, these are visual, ratings of how much green color is the canopy keeping? Is density starting to decline? We don't have any weeds here or any diseases or insect pests. So it's strictly mostly about green color of the canopy. Everything started off with a full, beautiful looking bent grass canopy. And then as we go, especially as we get to 21 days or week three and week four, there's a huge separation where once we start going below a quality of 7 down to below 6, that's a lot of loss of green color, the stand starting to thin, whereas all three of the treatments, whether it's humic acid by itself, seaweed by itself, or the combination of the two, are maintaining that statistically significant higher quality. And then we can go down to the photochemical efficiency data, and I guess we didn't do chlorophyll in this study.
Let me do here we go, right
in
here,
table two under drought. We can see, well, if we look at well watered PE first, we can see that it's all statistically about the same, close to 0.7.
well, this is comparing healthy. The cultivars, is that what you want me to show?
Oh, no, you're right.
I think there's another one that has
down farther. Get away from the...
Right here.
Cultivars.
Table four, I think. Is where you want me to go.
Right, okay. So again, we can still see across the treatments for photochemical efficiency, we're just sitting there at about 0.66 to 0.68. Okay. Healthy photosynthesis, healthy green tissue. Under drought, we can see that the control is 0.23, it's nearing non-functional photosynthesis, but especially the combination of the two, were at 0.4. Now that's still indicating tons of stress.
Sure. Yeah.
And some wilt starting to occur, but it's a big difference from the control.
Yeah. I mean, you're almost doubling.
And that's correlated with our visual ratings.
That's where I was going. Yeah. So you're almost doubling the photochemical efficiency at the same, in which is a means to an end, but at the same time, the end being the quality during drought stress is showing not only a separation between non-treated and the biostimulant treated, but the biostimulant treatment out to 28 days was maintaining an acceptable sword at 28, and the non-treated fell below acceptable limits at 28 days. So a month into it, there was not only a separation, but the non-treated was not acceptable. And here, this is certainly supporting evidence indicating that there is something going on in the plant with regard to photochemical efficiency that would help explain that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And, we stopped this trial at a month, but, what would be, and what we'd done in other papers is, and what you would do in real life, we've had that drought event, it rains, or we irrigate, we wake it up again, then we take it through another drought cycle, we wake it up again, and then we look at the end of the summer, where are our roots at? after repeated applications and repeated cycles of this stress. And that's when you'd really get a sense of, well, what happened to the canopy and what happened to the roots? Are there any roots that remained? I could show you, if we want to share my screen, I could show you the end of the summer at Wilmington Country Club on a recent study we did, the pictures of the roots, but, or we can,
you might be stretching, might be stretching my, you can email it to me. I might be able to put it on the screen if you want to take the time. I don't know if I might be able to, honestly, doctor, I'm not sure how to do that on my end, but if you email it to me, I can stick it in and it'll work. If you want to do that, basically while you're doing that, I was just going to say that, during the same study, you measure the roots and the shoots, and we don't see a statistical separation. But I always argue there's two sort of things we got to look at. We got to look at statistical significance occasionally, in many cases, but we also got to look at biological significance. In some cases, they don't always match. And in this case, we don't see a statistical significance between the control of roots, where it's at 0.95 grams in the pot, compared to the combination of BioStim, it's at 1.6 grams in the pot. We don't see it separate out. But biologically, you're almost doubling the roots when you're applying both humic acid and seaweed extract compared to the control. You're at 1.6 with these biostims compared to 0.9. Now, I'm not always comfortable doing that, but occasionally you'll see, oh, this is significantly different. It's a 6.5 versus a 6.3 on the quality scale. Well, practically, you're never going to see that difference, you know. So even though it pulled out, you're never going to see that in the field. So we got to be careful, you know, jumping to significance or differences when there is none statistically, but occasionally we can kind of see some movement. And the reason I'm saying that is when you look at across the drought roots and the well water roots, and you look at something like the mean here, they do pull out.
That's why we did that, because we thought there was something there.
Yeah.
We've got pictures of certain replications where there are big rooting differences. And so this is our way of, across the variability that happens with roots in field plots or in greenhouse pots, we were able to statistically say, I think there really was something here.
Yeah. And you make a point of that in the conclusion, saying that there were some small physiological differences that you all pulled out, but it seemed to be an internal difference, you know, that was really what was resulting in your observations or your measurements in turf quality. So is there anything else on that table, doctor, that you want to look at?
No. And you know, I didn't get a chance to email these pictures to you, cause they're in PowerPoint presentations.
That's okay.
Kind of hard to access right now.
No problem at all. So that's photochemical efficiency. That's turf quality. And just of those listening and watching there, we showed a line graph that showed turf quality changes over time, but this is at the end, I believe this was at the end of experiment one, the turf quality of the control under drought was 4.4, and the turf quality under drought with humic acid and seaweed extract was 6.3. And they were not only different biologically, but significant statistically, as well as just the individual treatments of humic acid and seaweed extract. So there's always this, and I always kind of cringe a little bit when people say this, there must be some synergistic effect and where we see each one individually not respond as well as they both do combined. And this is a little bit of evidence here where there was an increase in you're almost looking at a full point in quality when you apply both compared to when you apply individually, each one individually. And I don't know if there's any, this whole synergistic effect, I'm not always convinced that that's the case, but there's certainly an argument to be made in this case that potentially happened with this.
Yeah. So we put the combination in to this trial on purpose, because in the previous papers from Dr. Schmidt, the combination usually was the highest performer.
Okay.
And we're trying to think about why.
Yeah.
Part of it is in another trial that I did, which was based on a transplant rooting of Kentucky bluegrass sod. Mm-hmm. If you're forced on the job, which many of you are, to lay sod in May or June or in stressful time, what might you be able to do to enhance the rooting success of that establishment? And so in that trial, we used two different forms of humic acid by themselves.
Okay.
compared to a fertilized control. And his paper's published also. I could send it to you, or yeah, I could, you know, if you want to share it with your readers later.
Yeah.
But basically what we did is we laid the sod on a sand base, not, and on top of the sand was an open metal grate that then the roots
it's a good paper.
Developed down.
I've read it.
And then we were able to go back 2 weeks, 4 weeks later and grab the grate and measure the strength it took to rip the sod out of the ground.
Yep.
And there were large differences, and it didn't matter. We didn't look at seaweed extract in this trial because we were looking at humic acid as this rooting biostimulant, potentially because it has auxin in it. And it did have good effects. We had a leonardite based one, like in this study, which is the standard out in the industry products. And then we had a peat based one. And they both worked fairly equivalently.
Okay.
So
yeah,
there's that. So the theory is, okay, the humic acid is, to help with a little bit of new rooting during the stress, and the cytokinin is to help with the seaweed extract is to help with the cytokinins in the leaf tissue that's not being naturally supplied by the roots anymore.
Well, on that note, that brings me to table five. And we talked about this just briefly, so I got my bearings before we came on, is that the data seems to imply that very scenario, that where there seems to be a different effect, at least with the data. And again, correct me where I'm wrong. I can be completely wrong. But it seems that there's an effect that the humic acid is having that is different than the effect that the seaweed extract is having occasionally. And the reason I'm saying that is, and I want to direct your attention to table five over here in root weight, where we have just the humic acid alone is, let's say, 0.8 grams, and the control is 0.59, and they're separated out statistically. But the seaweed extract alone is not having that same effect on the roots. There's not an increase in root weight just with seaweed extract. It's from the humic acid. And I think, am I fair to say this? That's pretty consistent in the literature with humic acid. We seem to have, I mean, not every case, but many papers will show there's an effect beneficially on roots as a result of applying humic acid. Now, but when we go down to the next one down, which is this ZR, this zeaxanthin, this is a type of cytokinin, if I remember correctly.
Right, that's right.
It's the opposite, where humic acid is not having an effect on the this particular cytokinin in the leaf, but the two treatments with seaweed extract are.
That's right.
Okay. So I'm saying that to say, you know, if you're applying one, do you need to have a specific outcome or result in mind? In other words, if you're wanting to increase root production during stress, you wouldn't be applying a seaweed extract. Is that the case? You'd want to apply humic acid. Or how does it work?
I mean, but these products are, I mean, you can buy these and mix your own products. You can buy them as standalone ingredients and not spend a lot of money, or you can just rely on your favorite formulator, who most of the time, when you look at the label of the leading commercial biostimulants, both are in here anyway. And yes, in this paper and in the science, we're trying to separate which one is best for what. And I think there's good correlative evidence to back up what we're saying today. But you know, if I was using these products on the job, I would go ahead and buy something that has both in it.
Both. Yeah. Well, fair enough. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to understand the how and the why and
if you're operating in a situation where, like we said, transplanting sod, there's really not a reason for the seaweed extract. You want to get that quick root development, then just use a humic product. If you're talking about just general stress tolerance going through the summer, I would stick with a product that has both.
A mixture. Okay. Just real quick before we go on to something else, table five, I just want to point out that these cytokinins, notice how these line up exactly with the shoot weight in terms of humic acid not having an effect on either, but seaweed extract having a positive effect on both, on the, you know, the shoot weight mm-hmm. and the cytokine. And then of course mm-hmm. we have the opposite with root, which is what we mentioned. So I just wanted to make sure that that's clear. There seems to be a pretty clear difference in their functionality in the plant. And to your point, you're going to apply both anyway, then you're hitting it, you know, you're hitting on both ends. So I'm going to go down here. I just have a few things highlighted that I want to make sure I don't forget. And one reason I highlighted this, because I'm not just blowing smoke up your skirt here, doctor, is that I just don't see a lot of papers that really take the time to think about what is a reviewer going to say? How are they going to poke holes in my study? What do I need to measure before I start the study so that I account for as many things as I can? And in this study, you all did that. And I want to, either you or myself can read this paragraph, particularly almost verbatim, because it's a really good paragraph. I'm happy to read it if you can't read it on your end. I know your end's a little blurry.
Yeah.
It says, further, the data indicate that applications of the natural products in non-ash, so that's the raw product, not the elemental component of the product, increased leaf cytokine content, which is this zero, whatever mm-hmm. the thing is. However, the products, when ashed before foliar application, failed to affect that content, the cytokine content that was subject to drought. This supports the hypothesis, and I'm glad you said hypothesis, because it's hard to make a hard conclusion on these things, but you know, it's pretty good, pretty good evidence. Supports the hypothesis that the beneficial influences of humic acid and seaweed extract on turf grass abiotic stress tolerance are associated with their hormonal components, not the mineral fraction in these materials. Now, I could search the literature, which I've been doing for the last month, for a while, and not find a study that's that well thought out, I guess is the way to say it. Because a lot of these studies, I go, well, they didn't think about that. They didn't account for this. They didn't account for that. But it's hard for me to poke holes in the study. I'll be frank.
Well, thank you. And I mean, this was a concern that I heard from other colleagues mm-hmm. and a criticism of Dr. Schmidt's earlier work. Mm-hmm. So we go to these conferences, we talk science over beers, and mm-hmm. one particular colleague who was very skeptical about these products brought this up, and I took it to heart and said, okay, let's do it. And let's make sure when we do this study, he can't come at me again about this.
I did the exact same thing.
And look, this was my first study with these products, and I've continued to publish for the last 25 years mm-hmm. in this area with a new paper coming out soon, actually, on this USGA funded trial.
Okay.
And you know, I was the skeptic. Let's design this as well as we can to address these questions. Here's what we found, and we've continued to find similar things throughout the years.
Okay. I'm looking forward to your new paper coming out. I don't know if you care to kind of just, or if you even feel like comfortable mentioning just kind of the basic idea on that. Feel free if you want to. This has pretty much wrapped this up on my end on this paper.
Yeah. No, I'll just say that, you know, we USGA funded a trial at Wilmington Country Club near us that hosted the FedEx Cup 2 years ago for the BMW Championship. And this is one of their practice putting greens. We applied different plant health products every 2 weeks from May through October on this green that was being, again, maintained in championship conditions. We used seaweed extract. We didn't use the combination of the two in this study mm-hmm. Against Primo, against phosphite, against ASM, which is a salicylic acid mimic. That's in like Dakinil Action mm-hmm. Against a biological, a beneficial Bacillus bacteria. And that's the new part about this. Mm-hmm. And we tracked roots 3 times a year, spring, end of summer, end of fall. We looked at whether or not these products were producing basically certain pathogenesis related proteins that would upregulate defense responses. That so we did anyway. Long story short, we'll report on roots. And the picture I was going to show you is that it was the seaweed extract and the Bacillus beneficial bacteria that outperformed in terms of end of summer roots in this trial in the field under these kind of championship conditions. So I was excited about that because it's very, very hard to show these effects in the field versus more controlled environments like a greenhouse or a growth chamber.
Well, I want to make sure my audience hears exactly what Dr. Urban said, because I've said that many times myself. We start in the lab, we go to the greenhouse, and we get more and more error. It costs more and more money as we go from the lab out into the field. And when we get in the field, we don't always see what happened in the greenhouse and vice versa sometimes. I lean heavy. I mean, if we see something difference in the field, I'm more convinced that we can predict there would be a similar response under similar conditions in the field. But I can't always make that same conclusion from the greenhouse. I mean, sometimes clearly that's the case, but I can't always make that. I'm not near as confident, I should say. And so if you're seeing this in the field and you're planning on getting that published, I'm certainly looking forward to that, because a lot of these studies will see differences in the lab and the greenhouse. And then we go to the field, and even in nutrient work, any work. I mean, it's just the way it is. We just don't always see that, because our ability to control the error is just not as great in the field.
Right.
So that's all I got, Doctor. I only have two last questions. Okay. They're not related to any of this stuff. So unless
okay, give it to me.
What kind of turf grass do you have at your house?
It's just a tall fescue Kentucky bluegrass mix.
Okay.
Yep.
What would you put it on the quality scale?
It would be right around 6.5 to 7. I don't spend a lot of time on it, but I don't, you know, I also don't want it to be a pasture.
Right. I'm with you on that. And last question, if I were to go to the ASA meetings and ask your peers the following question, what would they say? Dr. Irving is an expert in this following area of turf grass science. What would they say?
Well, hopefully, biostimulants and plant growth regulators.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
I sincerely appreciate your time. As I mentioned, I understand in administration, your time is extremely important and pulled in, I don't know how many different ways. Thank you so much. I have about 1,000 more questions to ask you, but I have to wrap it up because I'll get too giddy and who knows where we'll go. We'll be here forever. But thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Travis. Thanks for the show. It's great.
I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Hang on real tight, Doctor. I'm going to say goodbye to everybody, and I'll be right back to you when I say goodbye. I'll be back tomorrow night, everybody, tomorrow, Thursday, for our 9 p.m. show tomorrow night. Thanks, everybody. Bye. Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Thanks.